that he brought NATO together, and to do it, he brought us to the edge of World War III. I mean,
no doubt.
You can't, yeah. And for other foreign policy, you know, he calls Afghanistan a success.
Yeah, well, there's a, look, we've got a problem.
Goes to the Pentagon, and they deliver it to Northrop, they deliver it to Lockheed, they deliver it to BAE, they deliver it to all of these companies with their headquarters in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. That's where three-fourths of the Pentagon money goes to these military contractors. And when NATO expands, those military contractors get even richer. What did Martin Luther King say about the Pentagon during the height of the Vietnam War? He referred to war and war preparation as a demonic, destructive suction tube that's sucking the resources. We can have higher education be free or cheap. You know, I mean, Bernie Sanders has had a proposal for years. You put a tax on Wall Street. That's a tiny tax on stock trades, right, bond trades, and derivatives. Right.
They call it the penny tax. Raise, any number of names, yeah.
Yeah, you could raise $2 trillion over a 10-year period and give, yes, make public education free, public higher education. But we just don't have that initiative from Biden. That's why we say open up the process so that the base of the party can get involved, and we would get a candidate, a standard bearer for the Democratic Party who could defeat the right wing, who's got more vigor, more force, more powers of articulation, is more progressive, more tied to working class people of multi-generation, multiracial.
Amazing. Jeff, can I just ask you to do like a 45-second riff on the current state of the media, in which,
yeah, sure,
you know, every member of MSNBC is also a member of the Biden administration?
Yeah, it's like an MSDNC. I mean, the problem with a lot of people who even listen to Pacifica is they also spend a lot of time with MSNBC,
yes,
or CNN,
yes,
or they're listening,
yes,
to NPR. I mean, you know, those news outlets, David Sirota's got the best line on that. Fox News mobilizes its viewers, makes them angry, makes them willing to take on even the Republican leadership. But what about MSNBC, CNN, NPR, the New York Times? They're anesthetizing their viewers and their readers to
it's
think,
so true.
Oh, just leave it to the Democratic Party. Just leave it. Biden is so strong. Biden did not. I remember during the debates where Biden was so inarticulate in 2000, in 2020, and you'd have the pundits would come on. Oh, he didn't hurt himself tonight. You know, he was barely coherent. But I mean, it's gone on now for years where the goal of those networks, it seems, is to anesthetize their viewers so that they believe, just leave it to the Democratic leadership, sit on the sidelines. That's why I love Flashpoints. It's why I love KPFA, because you're trying to mobilize people to get active and not just leave it to our benign Democratic Party leadership.
Beautiful. We're going to have to leave it right there. Jeff Cohen, Roots Action. Best way, people want to find out more about this Step Aside Joe campaign, what's best thing to do?
StepAsideJoe.org, or our website is RootsAction.org. Thanks,
Dennis. Thanks, Jeff. Stay safe. Be safe. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Short break. When we come back, we're going to be rebroadcast our interview with Kevin Kamashura about the court and affirmative action. Stay with us. The Supremes did it in their quest to essentially turn us back a couple of decades, if not a century. The Supreme Court ended affirmative action. Extraordinary situation. And we're going to talk about that today because it's got multiple implications. Our first guest said today that the Supreme Court decision is not surprising, but nonetheless a travesty, especially when viewed alongside the escalating attacks on curriculum and books, DEI initiatives, funding equity, and democratic processes. The decision to perpetuates the myth of colorblindness, that race no longer matters, and that democracy is somehow advanced when we refuse to attend to long-standing pervasive issues of racial injustices. Well, we are really happy that you could join us tonight, Dean Kumashiro. This is an extraordinary situation. You have been in the middle of this battle, Six Ways to Tuesday, and I wanted to begin just to give you a chance to unpack what is for you, what comes to, what's the heart of the matter, and what's the first fear that comes up around this?
Yeah, Dennis, thanks so much for having me back on your show and for addressing this really important topic. I feel like, you know, as you said, what this court basically does is strike down the probably the most common way that elite and competitive universities engage in affirmative action in admissions, which is to consider race as it tries to build a more diverse student body. And I think one of the things that stands out for me the most in this set of decisions around Harvard and UNC is the logic that they use to strike down the consideration of race. Like, I mean, drawing on 14th Amendment, Title VI of Civil Rights Act, basically what this court was trying to argue, wrongly so, like historically inaccurately so, is that Brown and even the former Supreme Court cases involving affirmative action, like Grutter, the 2003 case, that they were calling for and moving us toward a kind of a colorblind society, one where race doesn't really matter, and that the way we move there, the way that we address racial inequities, is to not attend to race. Right? It's this logic that basically says, well, if you are talking about race, then that's kind of racist, and so the best way that we can advance racial justice is to not address race, to not pay any attention to it. And so that's why affirmative action gets considered in this decision a form of racial discrimination, particularly against Asian Americans. So I think that's a kind of a common way of thinking about race and racism. It's the same logic, or at least it's a parallel logic, with all the censorship bans that are going on right now in schools, that are basically saying, hey, talking about racism is actually a form of advancing racism. So the best way to address race problems in this society is to stop talking about it. It's kind of this warped logic, but it's one that has worked itself very effectively in this most recent court decision. And I think it's why the work that lies ahead isn't simply a policy project. The work that lies ahead as we try to advance democracy and justice is also a cultural and a rhetorical one. It's a narrative project. It's one where we also need to change these very common misunderstandings of what is racial justice and how do we get there.
It's a bit, I guess you could say, cynical, if not diabolical, the way in which the Asian community is being used, and they're sort of the wedge in this battle to keep these affirmative action rights. And it was actually an Asian group that are the plaintiffs in this lawsuit. You want to unpack that for us a little bit and how you evaluate that?
Sure, sure. Yeah, the place of Asian Americans is very significant and very strategic. You know, it's the same. So the plaintiffs were actually a white group led by Edward Blum. And it's the same plaintiffs in the Fisher and or it's the same group that really led the Fisher versus UT Austin case that went before the court just a few, like a decade ago, right? It was decided in 2013 and then 2016. So Students for Fair Admissions is the group that's pushing these cases. And actually, not even though the face of this organization, like if you go to their website, the images that you see, the stories that you hear, the people speaking in the media, a lot of them are Asian Americans. There's actually not an Asian American a plaintiff. And so that's part of what's misleading about all of this is even, it's even more blatant that Asian Americans are positioned in a way that drives the conversation, that rallies people either for or against the topic, but they're actually being positioned in that way. It's actually not necessarily Asian Americans leading the struggle. So what's going on here is what should sound very familiar to those who are in California in the 1980s and 90s, you have a conflation of a number of different issues. You know, part of what drives this case is the notion that affirmative action hurts Asian Americans. But another factor and storyline that accompanies this case is the claim that there was anti-Asian bias in the review process. And a couple of notes about this. One is that the lower courts all found that there was not actually evidence of anti-Asian bias in the review processes of Harvard. But many people can point to lots of experiences in higher education of racial bias against Asian Americans, against any group, really. And so that's what sort of gets people fired up, I think, more easily, is we can all relate to that. I'm Asian American, a lot of us can point to examples of anti-Asian bias. And I bring up the case of the 1980s in California, because this is where we saw, to me, a preview of what just happened. Like, in the 1980s in California, there was a lot of controversy around anti-Asian bias in the review, in the admissions process. In other words, admissions reviewers were bringing stereotypical views, cultural insensitivity to the review process, and that was harming, some claimed, the chances of Asian Americans getting into the UC system. But what happened in the 80s was that these claims of anti-Asian bias, and, you know, clearly, bias is all over the place. So it probably was the case that there was a lot of examples of bias that were valid concerns. But what happened is that claims of anti-Asian bias got conflated with affirmative action. People were like, look, paying attention to race is hurting Asian Americans, and therefore, shouldn't we bring down affirmative action? And that's what then led to, of course, the Prop 209, 1996, which banned affirmative action in the public systems in California, and you saw very immediately you know, devastating numbers, right? Black, Latinx, and indigenous numbers of students in the California system plummeted. Same with Michigan, by the way, in 2006, following their ban on affirmative action. So Asian Americans have this long history of serving as a wedge against cross-racial solidarity when it comes to race-conscious policies. And just if I could throw out one more thing, just to back this up even more, in the 1960s, in the midst of the civil rights movement, is where you begin to see, many of us would argue, the genesis or the beginning of these kinds of narratives that position Asian Americans as a wedge, and that was the model minority stereotype. And this is the myth or the story that Asian Americans are the model for all other minority groups. Why? Because through their hard work and perseverance, they've made it. They've achieved the American dream. And this story, even though there was a lot of evidence at the time that showed us that Asian Americans were facing all kinds of struggles and barriers to success, it persisted because of its political salience, right? What better way to counter claims that there's systemic racism, like the civil rights movement? What's the heart of their argument is that we need to address historic and structural and systemic racism. Well, what better evidence or what better counter to that claim than to say, well, there can't be structural racism, because look, there's at least one group that through their hard work, they're making it. And maybe if all of you others could try as hard, you too could make it, right? Asian Americans served as a wedge back in the 1960s. They've served as a wedge in the 1980s in California, and they're serving it again. And what gives this story thrust or political salience is not just the notion that Asian Americans are evidence that there's no racism. It's also the notion that Asian Americans are harmed when you try to implement race-conscious policies. And that's why one of the concerns of a lot of Asian Americans in this moment is that the affirmative action decisions, because it played up on these model minority stereotypes, is going to fuel even more anti-Asian hate.
And I just want to add something now in terms, in the context of the mainstream media. You made an incredibly important point here, and you said the mainstream media is all over. Isn't it interesting that Asian Americans brought this suit to the Supreme Court? That's already been made into a fact. So you're saying that that is not what happened.
That's right. That's not what happened.
A big false fact that people are being fed now by the liberals who they love on, say, MSNBC.
Yeah, exactly. It's become taken for granted that Asian Americans are the one leading this. Asian Americans are not behind the organization. Asian Americans are not among the plaintiffs. Asian Americans did not testify, by the way, that affirmative action hurt them. There was not one testimony by Asian Americans that affirmative action policies have hurt their chances or have hurt them once they got into institutions. A lot of Asian Americans were testifying in the opposite direction, so, or at least provided testimony that would become part of the case. So yeah, I think media tends to pick up the sound bites that different people are putting out there, but haven't necessarily done their homework. And I think that just fuels our misunderstanding of what's at stake with this case.
And I'm going to tell you that it's also a problem. It appears to be a problem with the New York Times, who have helped to really create this illusion. It's just incredibly troubling. What I want to talk to you about, Doctor, is the implications. Affirmative action is sort of the transformational part of, are we going to live in the 21st century? Are we going to leave slavery and all those things behind or not? So it's a pivotal part of the, if you will, the human rights movement, which seems to be being unraveled now. Wouldn't you say, so the folks who want to take it all down, affirmative action is a major step forward in stepping backwards, right?
I see. Yeah, that's such a helpful way to put it. And one of the, if I can give a couple of examples.
I tortured it, but I got it. Thank you.
No, I think that's right. And I think there's a couple of examples of where the Supreme Court played a very central role in exactly what you're talking about, in sort of dismantling what could have been steps forward. So the way I think about the evolution of affirmative action as a concept is to first name 1961 is where we first hear from the Kennedy administration this language of affirmative action. And the idea, as it was put forward back then, was that we needed to take affirmative action, like intentional positive steps, to address historic and systemic problems, right? Things that are much bigger than the bad intentions of an individual. So when we talk about racism, it's not just a person acting badly against another. There's actually systems in place that have long been in place that disadvantage certain groups, favor others. And so affirmative action was one way to try to remedy these long-standing pervasive problems. Now that understanding of affirmative action got shifted with the first Supreme Court case regarding affirmative action in university admissions. And so this is 1978. And in that decision, what we got was a new understanding of affirmative action. That basically the court said, you know, you cannot have racial quotas, but you can consider race if these two criteria are met. A, race is one of many things that you look at, so not just racial quotas, but also B, you're going to argue that central to a high-quality educational experience is having a racially diverse institution. And so affirmative action now got defined as allowable only because it moves us towards this more kind of melting pot. It helps to diversify. It lost, in other words, its focus on addressing historic and systemic problems. And so let's shift forward to now. So this Supreme Court in 2023 has further narrowed our goals. So not only did it say we're not going to allow the consideration of race, it's time to bring to an end that policy, but they also even redefined the goal that we're working towards, right? So now we're not working. So in before 78, we said let's not work towards addressing historic systemic problems. Let's focus on just diversifying the pool. But now the Supreme Court is saying, no, the goal was never to explicitly address race. The goal has always been to move us toward not paying any attention to race. The goal has always been to act as if race isn't there, this colorblind ideology. And that, I think, is a very significant conceptual shift that is part of where we need to be pushing back. I would argue you don't advance racial justice by not looking at race, by ignoring that. You can't address racism by pretending it's not there. The way you address racism is you name where it exists and you explicitly sort of address it. You intervene. And that's where I think we need to double down and say there's a different set of interventions that need to happen than what the court has put out, but even different than what we've been doing so far. We have engaged in a limited form of affirmative action, and our job is to say this is a moment when we can imagine a different future and a different way forward, and so we need to rally towards that different vision.
Amazing. We are speaking with Dr. Kevin Kumashiro. He is the co-founder of the Nationwide Network Education Deans for Justice and Equity and the award-winning author of some 10 books or more. Dr. Kumashiro, as sort of putting on your, if you will, your organizing hat, your connections with educational leaders all over the country, what do you think has to happen now? Are you going to be doing some organizing? Do you think people are going to be coming together within the community that you've worked in for so long? How do you see this taking root? Because this is a big battle now.
Yes, I think this is a very big battle that will definitely be impacting particularly those universities that have relied on affirmative action. So I imagine that there's going to be short-term and long-term organizing or goals that we've set for ourselves. And the short-term would be finding alternative and creative ways to continue to build a diverse class. You know, one of the things that so Harvard admissions policies has often been held up, or at least has in the past has been held up by the courts as an example of how to use race legally, right? This whole, looking at the whole child, race is one aspect of what we look at. That actually has been pointed to as an example. So it's not surprising that the Harvard case was brought down. But the reason I bring this up is to say, as we got more and more, as sort of we've moved more and more towards banning affirmative action, several states already did that well before the Supreme Court made its ruling. So universities have already begun to come up with other ways to build a diverse class. But what I would say is significant about places like Harvard is they're trying to say that they're not simply like creaming off the top. They're not simply looking at those who have been the most successful and the most accomplished in conventional ways. That Harvard's argument has been that our job is to cultivate a very diverse student population, which means we're going to look at a whole range of things, not just the standard or conventional measures of achievement. And I actually think that that's the way that universities should be moving. I don't think any university has sort of figured it all out, including Harvard. But to say that our job isn't to simply reward those who've been most advantaged or reward those who've been the most accomplished, but rather to say we're going to look at people who are on the margins. We're going to build a class that helps us to build towards a different kind of future, that builds community capacity, that, you know, advances democracy and justice. Like, those are the kinds of goals we need to be working towards. So in the short term, I imagine universities will be coming up with more creative ways to continue to build that kind of a diverse class. And many universities have already found some ways, maybe not as effective, but some ways to increase diversity, racial diversity, without actually naming race, right? But I think in the long term, getting back to some of what I just said, I think the longer term struggle is to really reimagine what is the purpose of universities. Is the purpose of universities to help those who are already succeeding succeed even more? Or is the purpose of universities for the common good? Is it about strengthening communities? Is it about advancing democracy? And if, you know, I would argue that universities and schools in a democratic society are should be democratizing institutions. They should be actually advancing democracy, not merely helping individuals be more individually successful. And I don't think that that's a goal, or that that's a vision that we've come anywhere close to realizing. And so what I'm hoping and kind of presuming will happen is that there will be more organizing around that long-term strategy as well.
And it does seem that it does happen in the context of, for instance, you talk about in your statement today about the censorship and the book banning that is expanding. It's extraordinary how many books are on these lists across country. So it does appear to be of a piece really effectively perpetrated upon the society based on the ability of a certain kind of new, expanding, powerful minority rule.
Yes, and isn't that scary and dangerous? Or wouldn't we imagine that people in positions of power in the current social hierarchies in the society would be most concerned that you have historically marginalized populations that are becoming more mainstream, becoming more involved in democratic decision making, and quite frankly also becoming the majority? And I think you're pointing to a couple of things for me. One is that the many attacks on justice in education, whether it's censorship, whether it's funding, whether it's diversification, like through affirmative action, and the community governance, all of these things, they're actually tightly interconnected. Like, if we think about, I mentioned Edward Blum, one of the leader behind Students for Fair Admissions. Well, you know what else he was deeply involved in was changing voter laws, right? And increasing voter restrictions.
Yes.
Right? And
yes.
If we look at who's pushing for some of the censorship stuff now, well, it's the same the right-wing think tanks, organizing, media groups, lobbying groups that have long been pushing for things like vouchers, privatization, increasing choice. There's an interconnection among all of these initiatives that are about not merely weakening education as a common good, but more broadly about weakening democratizing institutions. There's a link between voting, and there's a link between funding and prisons and segregation and housing and healthcare. And there's a link between all of these things. And so, yes, as we think about what's the intervention of education, I think we do need to be drawing more explicit links between education as something that benefits individuals, and education as something that benefits larger society. But I also think that that's the kind of homework then that we need to do, is to be able to connect those dots so that we can make the argument that the impact we want education to have is a very different impact in society than those who are leading and winning right now in so many of the struggles regarding schools.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m. It's time for the bike show.
Let's get together to build.